Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network since 2009. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse. Snacky Tunes.
Hello and welcome back to Snacky Tunes. I hope you enjoyed the rest of your summer as we all did, and we are excited to be kicking off the fall season with a whole new show. First up, it's Emmeline Zhao, the managing partner and sommelier of the Silver Apricot in New York City. We talk about her growing up in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and Shanghai, what brought her into the restaurant world, and the stories she is telling through what she curates on the list at her restaurant. And then we head to Brooklyn for pop star turned jazz musician Senri Owe. He talks about his new album, his switch to jazz from pop music, and what he loves about being back in school. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes here on Heritage Radio Network. Emmeline, welcome to Snacky Tunes. Thank you for sitting down for a coast-to-coast conversation. Happy to have you on the show.
Thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you know, I was digging into your background and to your childhood, and I think what was so impressive is that you spent so much time traveling the world at a young age, from North Carolina to Shanghai, Tokyo, Sweden. What was your childhood that brought you to all these different cities and countries at such a young age?
I think it's a combination of having a very globally based family. My parents are from Shanghai. They came to the States in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And my mom ended up working for a Swedish company for about 30 years. We spent a lot of summers in Sweden, between, you know, there was Sweden, there was Shanghai. My mom's siblings all moved to Japan. And so my cousins on that side of the family are half Japanese. So I think having these little pockets of the world that were available to us because of family was kind of how all that happened.
Man, those Stockholm summers, the Swedish summers are magic, absolute magic.
Oh, I know. There's nothing like it.
There's nothing like it. So, I mean, traveling so much and seeing the world, how did that influence your palate? And then when did you also realize that you were having a different sort of food or childhood than other people?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, one, it probably made me a total brat. And
Do you not have herring, or where's your soy, you know?
Yeah, imagine that coming from, you know, the six-year-old sitting at... I think I knew from a pretty early age that what I ate was different and my preferences were different. Mm. You know, growing up in North Carolina in the 90s, kids don't know what, mm-hmm. you know, red braised pork is. And I spent, you know, my mom really didn't like us eating school meals, not to trash on school lunches, but
it's fine. No knocks.
There's some great ones nowadays.
Yes.
But at the time, she was very adamant about, you know, making sure that she knew what we were eating, that we were having good food. And so my lunches were always packed. They were always either made especially for lunch or leftovers from the night before. And they were definitely different. There were times where my friends, I still remember my friends called them chocolate eggs, but I used to have, you know, red braised or tea eggs in my meals.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, imagine the standard North Carolinian kid. They're like, what is that? So the running joke when I was a kid was I'd eat chocolate eggs for lunch.
I mean, just any sort of different cuisine. And we've talked about this in past episodes with different people, you know, in the 90s, especially where it was like very standard lunch in America. And that wanting to be, well, did you embrace it? Or did you want the Wonder Bread, French fries, pizza, chicken nuggets?
I will say that I think, given what you had mentioned about having a global childhood, that my palate was convinced enough that it knew what good food was, that it didn't want that. But at the same time, you still have this psychological sadness and, you know, feeling of being left out and being different. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of grappling with, I grappled a lot with like what I wanted versus what I felt like I should be. And I think that just folds into a larger question of, you know, having what is identity when it comes to being first generation in the States.
Yeah, no, I completely understand that, like, search for story and self and how you fit in. You know, traveling beyond just like the physical food itself, I'm sure you were also introduced to so many different types of customs and service approaches and the way that societies interacted with each other. Did you incorporate that into your approach to life, or what do you remember? Because you're going from east to west, especially in a time of less globalization, less connectivity.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. Things are so different in every country, and even within every country, things are different within regions. And I see that even traveling the U.S., you know, our cultures here, you know, our customs here in New York, dining out, are so different from where you are in L.A. But when you cross borders, I think that those contrasts are even more stark, and we can learn a lot from each other. You know, in China, for example, the service style is a lot more, I guess, demanding in the sense that the customer kind of directs how service goes. Whereas here in the States, you know, you enter a restaurant space and you are a guest of the restaurant, right?
Yes.
I think there are a lot of different ways that we do things, none of which are necessarily right. But I think that just comes with how we're accustomed to, you know, playing our part in society.
Being, you know, shown all these different societies and seeing all these different interactions and things like that, I feel like it can always lead you to different career choices. You know, food seems like the obvious fit, but I was reading that before you got into food, you got into journalism and you were writing first. What pulled you into that career space first? Was it the desire to share stories and share what you've seen, or was it just all the different people you met and just seeing, you know, I want to point my experience and point readers to what I've seen in the world?
Yeah. So I still am a journalist, and mm-hmm. I now focus more, less on writing and more on video and documentary production and multimedia. But the stories, I think, are what draw me most to both industries and both lines of work. Mm. I started in journalism, frankly, by accident. And as most things happen.
Yeah. I mean, so many people in restaurants, like, I just started washing dishes, and next thing I knew, 15 years later, I have a spot.
Yeah, exactly. And then you start wondering, you know, what was I thinking? Was I thinking? Why didn't I think? You know, and yeah. And here we are.
Now I have a lease. Yeah.
And now I suddenly have 25 people I'm responsible for. Like, how did this happen overnight? And it's, yeah, so I think I started, honestly, I got into journalism in college when a friend of mine, you know, I was always into photography. I knew I could write decently because I had won a few competitions in high school. And my first year in college, my friend said, you know, will you go to this interest meeting with me for the campus paper? And I said, what am I going to do? And she says, I don't know. You can take some pictures for them. And also there's going to be free pizza at the meeting. So I was like, done. Okay, great. College student, let's go. And I took a photo assignment at that meeting. And then when I went in to actually do the work a few days later, the news editor at the time said, hey, you know, the reporter for this assignment called out. Is there any way you can also write the story? And the rest is history. I never took another photo assignment again.
And, I mean, amazing.
Yeah. And so that kind of, it all kind of unfolded there. And, you know, like you said, you started as a dishwasher. You know, I started out as a reporter. And then the next thing I knew, I was the news editor there my junior year. And then I ended up, you know, I found my way to the 08 Olympics in 2000 in Beijing and was a reporter there. And then somehow found my way to the Wall Street Journal, which I'm still not convinced they didn't hire me as a mistake. But
wait, what do you mean? Like a clerical error?
Potentially. I still remember getting an email that was giving me information about onboarding. And I was like, wait, I never got an acceptance letter.
Just show up. Just, you know, it's like, yeah. You hired me. Weird, I'm not in the system, but I have the email, so, you know.
I rolled with it, they rolled with it, and here we are.
God, I love those stories. You know, I know you wrote for the Wall Street Journal, and you wrote for the Huffington Post, and that you were covering a lot of different topics. Were you able to cover food as, like, an analogy for some of the other topics you were reporting on, or were you reporting on more broad social themes and things like that?
Yeah, food was never really a part of my writing at the time. I was on the economics team for the Wall Street Journal, kind of coming out of the recession, and it was crazy to be. I felt like I was completely unqualified to be doing the work that I was doing at 22, but I was doing it. So I apologize in advance, or I guess retroactively apologize to anybody that was reading my stories that may or may not have been BS. But you know, I was also deeply fascinated by, you know, so in the States, we say that education is the great equalizer, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if you have an education, you have greater opportunity for social mobility. But that wasn't the case at the time. You know, during the recession, we were seeing a lot of folks going back to get their master's degrees, get their PhDs as a way of hiding out from the economy. But when they came out and when they graduated with those degrees, they still weren't finding jobs.
Oh, yeah.
And so I wanted to understand why that was. Was education no longer the great equalizer. And in doing so, kind of carved out this little niche for myself in education coverage. I ended up basically just going down this rabbit hole of education coverage and no longer really covered the economy as my primary beat. And so I've been covering education for the better part of 10 years now. But all of that said, you know, my two worlds finally collided actually a few months ago when I produced a documentary on a winemaking region in mm-hmm. California for the education nonprofit that I work for now called the 74.
The 74, yeah.
Yeah. And it was a really, really fun project to be able to see how all of these industries and these spaces actually intersect and work together. And there's a lot of synergy and symbiosis. So I don't know if that really answers your question, but.
It's great. It's definitely like this unique background and perspective that you have. And then being able to write these types of stories that only you could write and finding that through line, which makes for great journalists and also for great restaurant owners to have that singular point of view. All right, let's take a quick musical break because when I come back, I want to talk about how you got into the restaurant world and your partnership with Simone Tong and Silver Apricot in New York City. We have a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network. Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We're here with Emmeline Zhao, the managing partner and sommelier at Silver Apricot in New York City. And when we left in the last break, you were talking about journalism and how, you know, a few months ago, your worlds of food and journalism merged together. But I want to go back to when you were still writing. How did you get into the restaurant world? How did you start to make that transition in?
Yeah, when I'd always loved restaurants. I'd always loved food. And I was definitely one of those kids that, you know, when I had access to Food Network, that was that was always on in the background. When I was growing up, and, you know, my dad worked a lot, my mom traveled a lot, and there were times where I was often in charge of dinner, and I would always take a little whiteboard and make a whiteboard menu of what we were having that night. And
that's amazing.
Yeah, it was cute and sad all at once. And my mom also hosted a lot of dinner parties. My dad was kind of the center of an academic community there, and so we had a lot of those dinners at my house, and I helped my mom host and set the table and plan the party. So that had always been a part of my upbringing. And I think that when I moved to New York, I was also just so enamored and tantalized by the glitz and glamour of New York City restaurants and of, you know, of the, the celebrity chefs that you saw on TV. And I was kind of having a bit of an existential crisis, where I was deeply dissatisfied with the work that I was doing. And I wasn't sure if it was, I didn't know if it was because I didn't like who I was working for, or if I didn't like the actual work that I was doing. So I just needed to have a little bit of time for self-exploration. So I found out that, Wiley Dufresne, whose work I'd followed for a long time, was opening a new restaurant. And I figured, you know, why not reach out, send in a cover letter and a resume, and just see what happens, because I have nothing to lose at this point. Surprisingly, I got a call back. The general manager at the time, she called me in for a meeting, and I went and I said, why did you even bring me in for an interview? I have no experience on my resume. And I made that very clear in my cover letter. And she said, well, you wrote a cover letter.
And
in my mind, I didn't understand this, right? In all of the work that, all the fields that I've been in, cover letters kind of standard. And you don't realize until you're doing this that, like, no, nobody writes a cover letter in restaurants. And so, yeah, they hired me as a host, and I worked my way through pretty much every front of house job I could work there. And that's how I got into it. And it was working for Wiley that I met Simone Tong, my now chef partner. And there were many nights where she and I were chatting after service about hopes and dreams and potential and all of those things. And there was, I'd always known that she had always, she had wanted to go off on her own to open a restaurant of her own later on. And for me, I said, you know, because at the time I was no longer full time in journalism, but I was doing some freelance work, still just trying to figure out what I really wanted to do. And for me, it was, yeah, okay, restaurant sounds like me a good, decent, you know, retirement plan. We'll talk about this in 20, 30 years. But then she called me up about 3 or 4 years later and said, you know, I found a space. I'm going to open a restaurant. I found an investor.
That's how it always goes. That's how it goes. Oh, I found a space.
And she was doing some pop-ups for proof of concept.
I remember this.
And she said, come to a pop-up. And I said, okay, of course, I'll come support you. But by the way, like, if you need help, like, let me know. I'm happy to, you know, serve, host, whatever you need. And she's like, no, come eat food. It'll be a good time. So I bought 2 tickets, was going to bring my sister, and then about 24 hours before the pop-up, she calls me and she says, I need help.
Is that still on the table? Because I need it. I need it badly.
So relinquished my tickets, worked the pop-up. So I basically paid to work.
And I love it.
Then, and then ended up working all of the other pop-ups. And she asked me to formally join her on board for all of the little Tong concepts. So then, you know, now we're here. Silver Apricots are our fourth physical location, but our second concept.
I mean, what a beautiful story of just like meeting someone and liking them and then saying like, I'm going to roll my sleeves up and help you out in a pinch. I mean, it's, you don't hear that a lot. You usually hear like, yeah, I helped out. And then I was like, I got a taste. And I was like, no thank you ever again. What was the moment when you realized that you two could really make a run at this and be partners in business?
I'm not sure if there was necessarily an aha moment that was really the linchpin. But I do think that our personalities balance each other out really well as our strengths and weaknesses. She's also one of the, you know, I've worked for any number of chefs at this point, but she's one of the few that actually really absorbed feedback and really wanted to take all of the data points into account when she was making final decisions. And that was so refreshing and so appreciative. It showed me that, you know, she had an understanding that restaurants are not just a craft, you know, it is a business. It is being able to have a conversation with the guest and understanding what the guest wants. And she was beginning to understand that being a chef wasn't a one-way conversation. Or a one-way lecture, so to speak. It was more of a conversation with guests. And I think that she saw in me somebody who saw things beyond what we've always known was the status quo in restaurants. So a lot of the work that we did at Little Tong and that we're still continuing to do at Silver Apricot is to buck the status quo and to buck those trends and to really give our people a place where there is professional development and growth and support and a good culture. You know, I think that it's really important to have standards, but at the same time, you know, my people come first, and that's how we have operated then and how we will continue to operate.
I love that. So having Little Tong and having multiple locations, why open up a new spot? Why open up Silver Apricot? What's the story you wanted to tell with this restaurant that you felt you couldn't tell with the original concept? Or was there a different story that you wanted to tell?
It's definitely the latter. The Little Tong concept was really Simone's story because I was brought on later. Mm-hmm. Silver Apricot is a story that we wanted to tell together. She's an immigrant herself, but she's been in the U.S. for decades. I'm a first generation Chinese American. I was born in Wisconsin, grew up in North Carolina, right. But yeah. And I think that the story of being this generation of Chinese American hasn't really been told in restaurants in the States. We have a lot of, you know, very traditional Chinese restaurants, particularly if you look at, you know, places like New York and San Francisco, Chinatown, in the San Gabriel Valley where you are. It's a lot more traditional Chinese provincial, you know, focused. And then you have Chinese American takeout, a lot of that was, you know, actually born in San Francisco, Chinatown. But catered towards an American palate. I think that was a lot more of a deliberate cuisine rather than what we're trying to do at Silver Apricot, which is understand what it's like to be modern American Chinese. So I go back to the examples of what it was like for my parents to be in North Carolina in the 80s and 90s, not having had access to Chinese ingredients, which is now, you know, prevalent. You can get bok choy and things like that in grocery stores, right?
You took my example. I was like, I get bok choy at Trader Joe's, you know. Like,
exactly. But back then that was unheard of, right? Being in the Carolinas, it was, they go to the market and there's okra, there's collards, you know, there's corn. Yeah. And they're like, you know, what do we do with this? But cook what we know using what we can find here. And I think that is even then, just it speaks volumes to what we call now, you know, local seasonal farm to table.
Sure.
But that wasn't deliberate, right? That was circumstance. And I think that we really haven't highlighted, and I've realized as I talked to more first generation, that is more and more true, but we don't realize that. So there's mm-hmm. a whole generation, if not two generations, of Chinese Americans that grew up this way, that cooked this way, that ate this way. But, you know, stir fry collards and, you know, like okra porridge, like those were things that I ate. But I don't think that that's the type of cooking that we've really seen a lot in professional kitchens.
You know, I feel like this idea of rule breaking that you, or redefining the way that people do things based on tradition is so important, especially when you take a cuisine that you love and you're paying respect to something less deliberate and that was more circumstantial, but still trying to have ties to tradition and heritage. And I saw that with your Psalm selections as well, that you pull a lot of stuff that I don't want to say openly defies, because like it's a nodding tradition, but people doing stuff a different way. Can you talk a little bit how you're matching the drink program to the ethos and story and food of Silver Apricot?
Yeah, I love this question because I love talking about the winemakers. And again, maybe this is just the journalist in me, but like the stories behind the wine.
Yeah, it's the stories, yeah.
Those are the ones that really touch you. And I think it also alters your sense of taste when you understand where things come from and who the people are that are behind them. But I digress. Our wine program, you know, whether I did this to myself as torture or as a challenge, I don't really know. But when we were talking about, you know, the restaurant celebrating what it's like to be Chinese American, I thought long and hard about it. And I was like, why are we not celebrating the wines and the winemakers that are American or immigrant American or first generation American? Frankly, at the time, because, you know, when you start studying wine, you learn French and you learn Italian.
Sure.
And I really didn't know that much about American wines, except for what everybody knows about American wines, which is big Napa cabs. And I started to dive headfirst into it because I was like, well, it just makes too much sense. And I feel like I'm missing out on an incredible opportunity to celebrate the work that the people do here in this country if I don't lean into this and figure it out, really. And I started to realize that, oh my God, we have a really, really rich winemaking landscape here.
Mm-hmm.
Not only from the viticulture and the agricultural aspect, but also to the winemaking itself and the history behind what wine is in the US and the people that are doing it here. So we are, and we are highlighting a lot of, you know, I have wines from Virginia, from Michigan, from Wisconsin, from Minnesota. A lot of these folks are also doing things that we're doing. There's some that are saying, well, you know what? There are some indigenous, North American grapes that make phenomenal wines. Why do we have to use French and Italian varieties to make wine? We're planting these grapes on our soil. We should be able to pay homage to that. They're doing some incredibly inspiring and frankly groundbreaking work, scientifically speaking, too, to really advance the winemaking industry in the States. And also just a shout out to so many immigrant winemakers that are here in the US from old world wine regions, because they've, you know, like many of us, come to the US for opportunity, and they found that there's so many more ways that they can express themselves through wine here in the US. Versus their home countries and home regions. So our list very much celebrates all of those components in US wine.
It's amazing. It's reflected and it's, you know, you have a glass of wine from a type of varietal you've never had before with the, you know, Brussels sprouts and Chinese sausage. And you're like, oh, I know what I'm having, but it feels different and familiar, but like it just gets you thinking about like what food and drinks could be, especially when you allow yourself to just be open to a new experience or a new interpretation.
Very much so. And, you know, I think that this also dials back to the conversations. And I think we're having less of this conversation now, but, you know, at least 5 years ago, we were still having a conversation around authenticity when it comes mm-hmm. to ethnic cuisine. Mm-hmm. I think that people continuously want to prescribe cuisine to either authentic or fusion, and there's nothing in between. Whereas I think food is so fluid. It is all so many shades of gray. And I think that as long as you, the creator, whether you're in wine, whether you're in food, as long as you're being authentic to yourself, mm-hmm. we don't need to strive to be authentic to some tradition, right? And I think that seeking authenticity in the creator is what's most beautiful and magical about this space.
I love it. Now, before we run out of time, I know that music and the vibe is a really big part of Silver Apricot. So I'd love to hear a little bit about what you and staff plays. Set me the scene. It's Saturday night. You know, there's a cool breeze in New York. Everyone's out. We know winter's coming. What's on the playlist? What's the vibe of the restaurant?
Yeah, I think that it really depends on who's in charge of the team that night. I give a lot of license to our team to play nice. The music that they want to play and set the scene, because the vibes there really depend on who's working service, right? And so your experience at a table is going to be very much colored by the people and the servers that you're dealing with. And so they're the ones that are kind of running the show. But on any given night, you know, it could be Taylor Swift, because we're right across the street from Taylor Swift's old house on Cornelia Street. But then there are also some nights where they're feeling some, you know, EDM, and that's the kind of house music they want to go for. I mean, okay. I am all sorts of Southern, and I love my like Ben Folds and bluegrass, but I don't, but those are a little more like summer weekday kind of music, mm-hmm, I think.
Mm-hmm. No,
yeah. So we run the gamut of music out over there.
Amazing. Well, listen, thank you so much for taking the time and sharing your story. It's really great. And I can't wait to swing in the next time I'm in the city. If people want to check out the restaurant or follow along or see what's going on, where can they go? How can they check out what's happening?
We're on Instagram. Our handle is silverapricotnyc, and our website's not all too different. It's just silverapricot.nyc.
Oh, amazing. Well, big shout out to Ella and Cassandra over at Mona for putting us in touch. Thank you so much. We have a song from the archives and then a live performance from Senri Oye here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network. That's it.
Thank you so much. This was fun.
That was great. Hold on, I just got to do one pickup for myself. Just going to do the tag out one more time.
Go for it.
Big shout out and thank you to Ella and Cassandra over at Mona. We have a live performance from Senri Oye after a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network.
Don't abuse my love. Oh, I'm here for you now. And if loving you were to die, I'd do anything to try. But you always want. You cannot have. You push me away just to beg for me back. No, 'cause you always want. You cannot have. You push me away just to beg for me back. And darling,
my name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
Senri, welcome to Snacky Tunes. Thank you so much for taking the time to sit down and chat with me. It's so nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. My name is Senri Hoy. Jazz pianist, yeah. Jazz composer, yep.
Yeah, so much of what I love about jazz is this idea of reinventing a theme and like taking something that's been established and then personally reinterpreting it by the performer. How much has jazz come to represent and define your life?
I have to describe my background. I used to be a pop singer-songwriter for a long time in Japan, my country. So when I was 47, I've been on the other side a long time jazz lover. Mm-hmm. So when I was 47, I came to America, New York, with my tiny one-year-old girl dog, Dachshund Peace. So I launched my own label. P&D means Peace Never Die. And Peace became 17. And I almost 63 though, but still wow. Loving music and jazz and cooking, anything. Yep.
So going back to those days of being a pop star and you know, I've seen some of the footage at you at these giant stadiums and things like that. What was on your rider? Like, what were you eating at these giant concerts and what was food like on the road back then? Were they big giant meals where you getting to eat all over Japan and the world? What was food on the road like during the height of your pop stardom?
Oh, yeah. this is a good question, though. I don't know. Remember at that time because, you know, other than making music, doing concerts and meeting and transportation and taking nap in a green room. I didn't remember anything because, you know, always eating after big concert at the stadium, you know, stand the audience, I can see you, and arena people, yay, or something like that. Everyone yelling and sang my song, wave their hands together after, thanks so much, I'll see you tomorrow. And I have to slowly go back to a hotel and stop in by some grocery to have some, you know, miserable sandwich and Diet Coke. That's all. That's all. And watching TV and practicing next day's concert MC. You know, hello Nagasaki. Oh, next day tomorrow is Nagasaki. No, not Nagasaki. Osaka tomorrow. Osaka. Hello Osaka. Osaka, how are you? Yeah, no. So, something like that. And I'm fading out and I get up. Oh, this is new day, but still I have to do same thing.
Mm. You know?
That's my life.
Was that repetition that, like, you're in this cycle of pop music and performing and having these terrible sandwiches, you know, and having all this success, which is amazing, but did that help lead to this pivot of wanting to do a different direction with your music and getting into jazz, which I know is an early love for you, but we're like, I've reached these heights and maybe it's time to try something new?
That's a very high-end question because at that time, you know, the music drove me creating a lot of tunes. Mm. So when I standing on the platform of a bullet train, Shinkansen, in Japan. Oh, I found there some melody. I pick up the phone, pay phone around that time. Mm. And I sang the phrase, this is 1:30 p.m. Osaka. So I hope you will be able to create new melody. Thank you, Senri. Bye. Like that. So that chunk, a lot of chunk tied together, I'm making, creating anything. So always that kind of thing. So music, strong power, gave me a lot of chance, opportunity to expand my life. You know, around that time, music drove me to the actor's world because I used to do acting. So that's interesting possibility, chance, and a lot of things. But on the other hand, I have been a big fan of jazz.
Yeah.
So every day I never forget how someday I want to learn my favorite music and I want to be a pianist. That's my small dreams. But when I was 47, dreams come true. My choice was, enter to music conservatory. So that's why I came here, New York. Yeah.
Was there one specific moment where you said, I'm going to just move or put a pause into the pop career and move to New York into jazz? Do you remember one thing or was it just this gradual thing, as you said, where you were hearing this music everywhere, you've had this love for jazz? Was it a gradual thing or like you just felt in this moment, I'm 47, I got to go?
Not graduate. I always, you know, climbing my mountain to the pinnacle. But two things I remember. The first one is one of my friend, musician. So he used to be in Europe for a long time. Accordion musician. Kind of jazz, classical music. And me and Koba was doing a rehearsal for program. So he just said to me, Senri, between you and me, you can go to Europe or America to be a real. So, oh my God. He understands how I feel. In Japan, I almost satisfied my career, but still I'm struggling to be someone every minute. So his insight, you know, makes me, okay, I want to do more. That's the first one. And the second one is one of my audience said just after I did the improvisation on my stage, Senri, you have to do a more precise music. Don't improvise. pop is more precise. You have to do what you rehearsed in the studio. Follow that. So that phrase makes me, I don't want to do a negative thing, but this is might be a great timing to move to another dimension of my life. I have to open my second chapter of my life. At that time, I really thought. So a little by little, I started to research what is good for me. So I found a new school for jazz.
Amazing. Well, I want to hear a song. What is the first song you want to play for us, and what's the story behind it?
And this is Akiuta 5-4 and 6-8, some kind of a combination song. Akiuta in Japanese meaning fall autumn tune.
Amazing. Well, we have Senri Oe here live on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network. Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. That was just Senryu Away playing live for us. And, you know, you moved to New York to study jazz. Mm-hmm. Why New York? Why not stick around in Japan? Was it both the level of school and learning and understanding of jazz you can get in New York? Or was it also this idea of leaving Japan where you'd become defined as one type of musician and you could go to New York and just be not anonymous, but sort of fade into the fabric of life there?
There was three reasons. So the first one, in the early 90s, I had been back and forth between New York and Tokyo for a long time, and I rent a small room apartment in a village. So every day I passed a lot of jazz wannabe students go to a new school for jazz. So for me, who really love jazz, someday I also want to be, students who learn how to do jazz theory, training, side music, a lot of things, rhythmic something, I want to do that. That's my dream. This is first one. And second one is just like a change, the intersection signal, red to green. I tried to apply to Berkeley music in Korea first because I was so close at the first. It might be good. So I tried to do that, but no response. And I tried to do a Juilliard and Manhattan School of Music, but no answer. So after
how many gold records do you need to get a response, right?
So after that, I asked my mentor, the bass player, my mentor, Sam. That Sam said, I want to be your helper. I play with you and to make a demo tape to a new school. So we did a great demo tape, and I wrote the English introduction. If you take me to your school, I can write some best tune for, female singer, and that gonna be a number one of Jazz Week or something like that. So that's number two. And number three is, I feel familiar, New York. Yeah. I love that. And every day after going back to my place apartment, I want to go to some jazz venue to listen to legend musicians. So one, two, three reasons. Yeah.
I mean, I love it. And, you moved to New York during a great era, 2008. I was living in New York at the same time. I was living in Williamsburg and Brooklyn and New York, Manhattan at that time was just so creative. There was such a feeling in the city of just anything was possible. Let's go make some art. Let's make some music. What do you remember as being inspiring at that time? What do you remember feeling that was just getting you creatively going? And when did you realize you had made the right decision?
Every day when I went to a jazz standard to listen to Maria Schneider. So I was in the first table just in front of the stage, and she left her cell phone on my table, and she said to me, "You have to count running time." Okay. So I was so surprised, but, very friendly. So that's a delish moment. And also, I tried to talk to Frank West, and he gave me his private number. So if you like to wanna do a lesson or take lesson or something, you can call me in person. Wow. And I called him, and we talked half an hour. So just before he passed away. So that's my treasure memory. And also in a Birdland green room. Some musician tried to give me a very encouraged saying something. A lot of memories.
Going back to school at that age, especially given the career that you had, has to be pretty incredible, given the fact that you've had all this success and then you were studying with all these kids who were so much younger than you. What did you learn from them? You know, what did you take away from them? And did you teach them anything from your career on the road?
Yeah, when I used to be a singer-songwriter in Japan, almost self-taught every day, you know, curriculum that I made every minute. So I learned from me by me, and I tried to do some new, and from there I learned again every day, you know, repeat, like that life was me. But when I into the curriculum in new school, other than me, I was 50. And other than me, everyone 18, 19, 20, wow. 21, who can do already jazz, you know?
Right, right.
So the one person, very older, much older than teacher, and also didn't know anything about jazz. So
you knew a little about jazz, a little bit.
Yeah, but the feeling, my feeling.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
But, you know, I don't know the Ionian, you know, I don't know the rhythmic, you know, subdivision or something like that. I didn't know that at all. So now every day in the class, the teacher said, especially in the sight reading, you know, Sally, come on. And said in front of the piano, you have to do from the first bar, back invention. And you don't have to do any mistakes. Slow is okay. You have to keep on your pace, but no without mistakes. So that everyone come, surround Senri. And I couldn't do that. And I failed. And the teacher said, this is the baddest example. Oh my God. This is baddest in my life. But, you know, on the other hand, I felt, oh my God, this is what I wanted. Because, you know, in Japan, people around me try to help me. You know, always, Senri, you want a towel, you want a food, you want a something, you know, everybody tried to take care of me, just like, you know, I was the Justin Timberlake, you know. Yeah, just what I have to do is just dry my sweat. So I thought, on the other hand, oh, this is a right way. I have to learn from here. So I have to share the honky-tonk, out-tuned piano with Max from New Jersey, who really good at piano, just piano. But he always kick a piano, a fake piano. Oh my God, I hate this piano or something, but he's good at jazz piano. But I said slightly, Max, don't hit the piano. Don't hit the piano, Max. What? Don't hit the piano. piano is piano. We have to carry piano together. Okay, Sanri. That conversation every day. Every day. So somebody came to me. Hey, you, in this class, just one person doesn't know jazz. I don't feel comfortable. I'm sorry, Peter. I said, Peter. Peter, what I should do, you know any best teacher, jazz teacher, you should recommend for me. You have to look for by yourself. This Oh my God, you're very cold. But, you know, after that, I learned, you know, Aaron Goldberg said, you used to be a singer-songwriter. You don't write down. Transcribe is by your ears. And you have to sing. Okay. You have to keep on singing. That's Aaron way. So I learned a lot from Aaron Goldberg and Junior Manso. Always between Junior and me in the class private lesson, I'm not senior, I'm junior. And I'm junior. Hey, and when I start to play piano, no, I want to play. So 95%, I was the listener, happy listener, listen to Junior Man's playing. Incredible.
Amazing. Yeah. Let's take a little break and hear another song right now. What are you gonna play for us?
I have been a big fan of Tony Carlos Jobim, so I got a big influence from him. This is the Lauro G. Freitas.
Oh, amazing. All right, it's Senri Oe here live on Stacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network. Thank you. Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. That was just our musical guest, Senri Oe, playing live for us. And when I think about my time living in Williamsburg in New York, and when I go back to visit, I always think about the food and I'm always planning my meals. Where do you like to eat? Where do you like to shop? I know you do a lot of cooking. What's your food life in Brooklyn like?
My favorite place is Williamsburg, of course, mm-hmm. especially along the coast. Mm-hmm. Used to be a sugar factory.
Mm-hmm. You know, and the Domino factory. Yeah, exactly.
You know well. You know better.
Yeah, I used to live there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, around that. And Dumbo. Mm-hmm. You know, under the Manhattan Bridge, Brooklyn Bridge, around that area too. I love the Brooklyn Heights, that area, mm-hmm. very fancy though. I love that. And also, I love the Jefferson.
Mm-hmm. There's some good new restaurants and bars out there as well.
Yeah, that's true. And a lot of murals on the wall. Mm-hmm. So wherever I go, I can take good pictures. Mm-hmm. So I love that. Very, yeah.
And I know that you cook a lot as well, so much so that you put out your own cookbook. What's the story behind that? How did you start putting recipes together? What made you want to put out your own recipe collection?
That's a practical reason, especially in the pandemic. I have to cook, you know, I have to stay home and using a leftover in the fridge. So I open the fridge, cucumber, shiitake, mushroom, and tomato, tofu. I have to do a shiitake, mushroom, tofu, spaghetti or something like that with a garlic peperoncino or something like that. So I discover a lot of, you know, the way be a good food around the era. And once I hang out with my friend, that's going to be a great meaningful because every day I have to cook. So that pandemic era makes me, been a life chef. So I am now much, you know, better life manager, you know. Mm-hmm. Cooking a lot and limited ingredients give me a lot of ideas to make unknown stuff coming up from me. So every minute's cooking makes me just like composing, improvisation, and very, very tense. You know, I am the last customer, the last day of his life. So for him, I would like to be a best chef for me. So yes, that's a concept of my book.
Yeah. I love it. And when you're cooking, what are you listening to? Is it your own music? Is it jazz? Is it pop? What do you have playing in the background when you're in the kitchen?
Oh my God. No music because, you know, in my brain, a lot of music always, you know, stirring up. So I can't control. So besides, you know, scissoring sounds and that makes me, you know, a lot of our energy. So I don't need any music around the cooking time. So I always just like a Zen monk.
I find that I cook a lot in silence as well. I always think that I want to put something on and then I just need the quiet. I just need to hear the food cook and I need to hear the different sounds of the kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, you're in New York now. You've put out your eighth album, your jazz album, Class of 88, which is really interesting because it marries some of your old pop career with your jazz career. Mm-hmm. What, and I know that you did that on earlier albums like Boys and Girls. What made you want to go back now that you've established yourself, you've played at Birdland and you're in New York and you're fully entrenched in the city? Mm. When, what made you say, like, I want to bring part of this other career back and marry it to my current career?
The more I indulge in the jazz music here in Brooklyn, the more I can feel, oh, music has no border. You know, beyond the jazz, I would like to be someone who can make music, play music. So a little by little, I'm transforming to try to combine my old music, 80s, 90s, and 2022-23, because I already written a lot of ideas in that era. I started to listen to that. Even though those are written by me, I really inspired from there. You know, already a chord progression is very, you know, precise and comfortable, accessible, friendly. Oh my God, I want to do a more friendly Beatles jazz, you know, all over the world, the people hum like this. Oh, San Ray's Puppets, you know, oh, if I can do that, I'm the only person who can do that, because, you know, I did pop music in Japan. I'm now trying to do some new Stanley jazz here in Brooklyn. So that's why little by little I'm transforming to this dimension. So
I love it. It's that reinvention of your own theme, your own music. Well, listen, I want to make sure we have enough time for one more song, but if people want to listen to your music or follow along or see when you're playing your next shows, where can they go? How can they see what you're up to these days?
September 22nd, I want to be appearing on Arto Boutique and Second Valley, San Jose venue as a solo piano, and 8 p.m. And after October 5th, as a trio, we are appearing on stage of Dazzle in Denver, Colorado.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah, and the end of this year, our trio are going to do touring in Japan, Blue Note Tour. Yeah.
Wow. Bring it on home, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, amazing. So what is the last song you have for us, and what's the story behind it?
This was from the 1, 2, 3, 4 I made 1988.
Wow.
So that was the changing time for me. I tried to pick up some motif from my real life for my lyric world. So that's a very changeable transition time. That's why I call my new album, Jazz New Album, Class of 88s. But knock, 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 to 88. You know, from jazz, from pop, you can combine music is music, the idea. So from there, Glory Days, original title Glory Days, but, you know, that's a little bit church title, so otherwise born in USA. So
Boss, yeah, a little Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah. So I change my Glory Days. Yeah.
I love it. I love it. Well, Senri, congratulations. Thank you for sitting down.
Thanks so much.
Thank you to Don and Roberta as well for helping to set this up. Senri away, my Glory
thank
Days.
You, Dan.
Yes, live on Snacky Tunes here on Heritage Radio Network. We'll see you next week.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Snacky Tunes is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaeli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.